very easy to spin up a very large compute environment and query from the data, as long as that data is organized. And that's something that I feel like I harp on a lot when I speak at conferences and stuff, but it truly is the most important thing, is having data that's accessible is data that's usable. And if it's usable, then you can slap together a really easy dashboard that can really deliver a considerable amount of insights that otherwise would be completely hidden from you.
Welcome to the Leaders of B2B podcast, a weekly show where we bring you interviews and in-the-weeds expertise with today's B2B experts and thought leaders. You can see more about today's episode and guest by visiting our website at leadersofb2b.com.
Hey, leaders, welcome back. Today, I am excited to welcome Colby Ford to the show. Colby, you got a whole lot of interesting things going on. I love browsing down a LinkedIn profile where almost all the jobs on the first page say going till present. It comes to your opportunity to tell us about all those activities, and maybe we'll talk about time management because that's a lot of stuff.
It's unfortunate that LinkedIn doesn't allow you to show that you do multiple things at once. They have a very linear view of the universe, and I am not a very linear person. So.
Yeah, I'd love to hear about each of the projects, and then we could talk about your disciplines overall.
So right now, I run a consulting company called Tuple. We are a Microsoft partner and Databricks partner consulting firm that focuses in the health and life sciences space, mainly in the biotech world. And I think we're the only genomics-based partner in the Microsoft ecosystem. So we really design and build very large-scale cloud infrastructure to support everything from drug discovery to very large-scale genomics to just scientific computational needs. And then in addition to that, I am a co-founder of a company called Amisa. We're an NSF and NIH-backed startup that works in the Alzheimer's space. So we use wearable devices, just normal smartwatches like the Apple Watch, the Samsung Galaxy Watch, to monitor people with dementia and related Alzheimer's diseases or neurological diseases. And we enable remote patient monitoring for research, but also remote monitoring for caregivers and loved ones or patients. And then, as if that's not enough, I'm a faculty member at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte, in the CIPR Center, which is the Center for Infectious Diseases and Pandemic Preparedness, where I do a lot of research in the infectious disease space around things like SARS-CoV-2 and other diseases.
Great. So your academic background is all kinds of things and words I can barely even pronounce. I've seen you describe yourself as a polymath, which I think is one of my favorite concepts. I've seen you, one of your profiles says something about a recovering academic. So you're an entrepreneur and you use the word interdisciplinary a lot. And I think that's interesting because a lot of business leaders took that path. I studied business and I do business. And you now have managed to merge all kinds of highly technical disciplines along with that. And I think that story would be interesting.
Yeah, I think interdisciplinary work is where things can push the boundary a little bit more, because when you're in a given area, whatever that is, whether it's biology or computer science or math or whatever it is, you can see and learn about what everyone's doing in that field and things that are working really well. And then you go to another field and start learning about the problems there. And then all of a sudden you start saying, oh, wait, I know about this thing that works over in this other field. Let's try and apply it here. And oftentimes it works. And that's really where I see interdisciplinary research is starting to grow, in the sense that we can cross apply lessons learned, things that work, things that don't work between different fields. I jokingly refer to myself as the recovering academic because I've bobbed kind of in and out of academia over the years, in addition to consulting and in addition to other entrepreneurial endeavors and working at pharma companies and everything else. But what's been really interesting is learning what things are happening on the bleeding edge and like in academia, and then what things work really well from an enterprise perspective and blending those. And that's what I really focus on now, is delivering that to my clients as a consultant, is kind of bridging that gap between something that's cool, but also something that works in an enterprise setting.
Like stuff that came out of the lab into practicality and scale. And so it's not just a provable thing. It's now a thing that we can deploy exascale. And it's an opportune time, I guess, to be talking about the things you do, like massive growth of cloud in the last 20 years. And then obviously, like the AI curve now is exploding over the last few years, although I imagine folks like you have been doing that for a bit longer until the news cycle caught up with it. But these are exciting and like sort of problems that we couldn't have solved without this type of infrastructure. And that strikes me as like a existentially awesome type of opportunity, a good time to be alive. What will, in normal language that dumb people like me can understand, like what is going on out there that you can, you know, met?
In the life sciences world, what's happening and what's been happening for a while is that things are getting cheaper to test or to sequence or whatever. So previously, if you wanted to sequence a genome, let's say you're a pharma company and you want to run everyone that's in your clinical trial through a sequencing process so we can understand what's going on, it's very expensive from a what's called a CLIA perspective or a lab grade perspective is or clinical grade perspective that you're talking over $1,000 per patient just for the bare minimum kind of sequencing. And now what we've seen over the last year or so in 2023, we saw a couple companies that are promising $100 genome. When we go and grab that genome, it's not, okay, what comes out of the sequencing machine is ready to go and just tells us all sorts of information. It doesn't. There's this pretty complex, computationally complex pipeline that generates a ton of data out of it. And we have to be able to manage that to derive any sort of insights that you want to use in a clinical setting or even in a research setting. And so I think this is one of the biggest things where we see the cloud being very useful is now we can store that data, we can access that data, and we can process it at scale. And we're not really limited by that bottleneck that we would have been before. And as technologies improve, these technologies produce more data, and we have to have a way of storing it, accessing it, using it, et cetera. And so that's really where I think the cloud kind of shines and is just a very obvious choice when we go to think about things in the life sciences.
How much data is one genome?
It depends without getting into the weeds, but you could think of it as 100 gigabytes for just the base amount of information. So the sequences that we get off the machines aren't that big, but then when we require all this like reference data that we have to look at, then it grows quite large. And then there's lots of things above and beyond just that information that we might collect on a patient, like how are they doing on a drug program, like in a clinical trial, or how are they responding to a drug? So there's a lot of ancillary data that needs to go along with it. And usually one of the biggest things too is not that I want to look at an individual patient or a client of mine, I want to look at one patient. They want to look at hundreds or thousands of patients across the gambit of their trial. And so really having that data organized in a way that you can access that and ask questions of that data is really where the cloud shines if you get it right.
Yeah, I feel important now. Like I'm 100 gigabytes of data.
You're worth more than that.
Is it Thoreau? I contain multitudes.
Yeah, something like that.
And then you have built these partnerships, right, with Microsoft and other big companies. And I just look at that and I think that's a thing that every entrepreneur would really want to do. And like you brought your expertise, you know, into that and then can create these large-scale relationships to align your clients with the right technology and your expertise. And there's an obvious networking and relationship case going on there that is a really important component of being able to execute projects of this scale. I'd love if you would talk about that.
Yeah, I could talk a little bit about partnerships. In the tech world, if you run a technology company, whether that's a company that makes software or does consulting, whatever, there are plenty of opportunities to partner with the larger organizations, the Microsofts, the Amazons, the Databricks of the world. I would say, and I would caution listeners of this podcast, that sometimes those partnerships are a little more, they're not exactly as symbiotic as you would want. And so that you really have to work really hard to make sure that you're getting something out of the partnership as well, that it's not some sort of parasitic relationship, to bring a biology term in there. And so I would say one of the things with the Microsoft partnership, and Microsoft has various different types of partners. You can be a system integrator, you can be an independent software vendor. There's lots of different ones. And they do a really good job. If you show value and you bring value to clients that causes revenue spend on the Microsoft side, then they will also in turn bring you additional clients. Like it's a kind of a cyclical thing that happens. And it's not overnight. And it's not necessarily that I've got 75 emails from Microsoft every day, but it is something I do truly get a benefit out of that partnership. Whereas there are other companies who have asked me to partner with them to do things that do not provide anything. All they want is my logo on their website and they want me to bring them money. And I'm like, well, you're the multi-billion dollar company. Why am I doing that for you? So I would say, I would caution your listeners to really make sure that if you enter into a partnership, that it is a partnership, it is symbiotic, and both parties are getting something out of it. And one easy way is if you're working on becoming a partner for some of these organizations and it's pay to play, you got to pay multiple thousands of dollars to get your logo on their site, and you're not recouping that in the first year, don't do it that second year because they don't need to charge. I mean, it really could work quite well. And things like the Microsoft partnership.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I have, in fact, fallen victim to that once or twice myself. And they're just like, oh, yeah, we'll bring you business and you just got to pay this onboarding fee. And that is not how it works out. Now, we did make our money back.
There's a side of that where, like, I understand the point of pay to play, where that way they don't have a million partners that aren't doing anything in the system. But there also should be, like, you should be able to recoup that money if you try. And I would say, too, outside of technical partnerships with these other companies, if you're because I work in the health and life sciences space, one thing that I've learned is that different types of partnerships operate very differently in the HLS space. So if I go and I want to work with an academic research institution, that operates differently than an academic medical center. That operates differently than a doctor's office. That's different than a pharma company. That's different than a biotech company. And they all operate very differently, both in terms of what they need from you, but also in terms of how quickly they can move, what they can pay, and all sorts of other factors that are quite diverse across the gamut of HLS companies.
How did you figure this stuff out? Where did this come in your business development evolution? Because it's complex. Like, I've been through a lot of partnership agreements, and you got to figure this out, or did you learn it the hard way? Or
I think some of it, because I have been in academia for so long, the academic partnership stuff was a little more obvious to begin with, because I'd seen it from the inside, seen things fail and whatever. But previously, before starting Tuple, I worked for another very large Microsoft partner firm, which has since been acquired. But that company did a lot of stuff in the healthcare space as well. And I saw how the life cycle of those clients worked, where some institutions were ready to hit the ground running. They could get you access to their stuff. You could start working within a week. And then there were some where the life cycle of getting through the vendor onboarding was 6 months, right? And sometimes you can feel for that. What it really comes down to is, how do you price yourself so that you're not wasting your money on that wasted time? Because the wasted time is something you can't control.
And packaging your own consulting and your expertise. You know, there's that period of when I've been doing consulting for 20 years. And at some point you realize I'm not selling my time, I'm selling value, you know, that accumulated experience and value that you can bring much faster. Where was that for you? How did you navigate that?
Yeah, a lot of error. Few trials, lots of errors, right? I think the biggest thing is there are two different pricing models that I often see in the consulting world. One is T&M, time and materials, right? Where you're just keeping a spreadsheet and tracking your time and billing the client for that time. Sometimes that can be quite lucrative in the sense that if that client really needs you for 40 hours a week, you can bill accordingly. The struggle is when you get really good and you can do something very quickly, it does not behoove you to operate very quickly because you're charging by the hour. And so the other mode of charging is what I call deliverable-based pricing, where I take a project, I split it into a few deliverables, and then whether I get that deliverable done in 5 minutes, 5 days, 5 months, I get paid the same amount. And usually then you're really baking into the fact of, like, all right, I'm going to deliver this value very quickly, and therefore you can charge a bit of a premium on it with a little bit of buffer, because things go wrong and sometimes it's not up to you. If it's a 5 minute task, but it takes you 3 weeks to get access to the system, you can't do much about that. But so oftentimes with most of my clients now, I do deliverable based pricing so that it behooves us both to, I can work very quickly. And if I work quickly and deliver it quickly, the client gets value quickly, but they are paying a bit of a premium in order to get that quickly. There's a big difference too. There's a former student that asked a couple weeks ago, a former employee asked about starting his own kind of consulting firm. And I mentioned there's a big difference in being a contractor and being a consultant. And I'm not saying one is better than the other, but they do have very different, first, how you charge, and also usually what you're working on. Oftentimes with consultants, you're working on some complex tasks that the company can't solve themselves without hiring a bunch of people. Whereas a contractor is really working more on the very task where the smaller, more kind of long-term tasks where they need a warm body in the seat that's still maybe skilled, but it's a little bit of a different thing.
Yeah. And a lot of people, and I think this is fine, a lot of us who started consulting companies were actually contractors just to get the bills paid, and then slowly worked up to be able to do more brain work. I think that's the thing. Is it task oriented, or does it become something where my expertise actually matters here and I'm not just, you know, billing? And there's nothing wrong with billing when you need to pay the bills.
And I think some of it too is above and beyond just expertise. Is some of it's like, well, if I've done this 25 times, I'm going to be able to deliver it and do it correctly because I've done it correctly 25 times for that client. So sometimes for anyone listening that is trying to just start out, it is a little difficult to be like a pro consultant out the gate, right? You might have to start as a person that builds up that repertoire of successful projects as a contractor or as an employee at other companies too. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Did you see the path to where you're at now, or is it like a planned thing? Or I talk to people that I had goals and I'm doing it. And then there were the ones that, you know, well, every couple, 3 years, like something new came along and I took a path that I didn't know about.
I'd love to tell you like, oh, I know exactly what my plan is and I executed it. It was perfect on the first try. No, that's not it at all. When I worked for, like I said, I bobbed and weaved through academia and pharma and bio and med device and other companies in the past. And when I was working at the previous consulting group, at one point they split off. We used to be very technology focused. So like I worked in the AI group and then there was a data platform group and a business intelligence group. And then they reorged the company where people were assigned to various industries. So we had a retail group and a finance group and we had a healthcare group. And one thing that I saw from that is that we oftentimes were getting brought into discussions that were really more life sciencey. And that's very different than healthcare in and of itself, right? Healthcare could include everything from payers and like an organizational efficiency at a hospital, right? That's different than running a drug trial at a pharma company or designing the next drug or doing some sort of agriculture project on genetically modified wheat or something. Like it's a very different thing. And so I had asked to split off my own sort of arm at that company and do more life science stuff. And that worked for a while. And then, like I said, that company got acquired. And so as that company got acquired, I was like, there's enough business here for me to do this just on my own. And that's how it happened. A little bit of serendipity, a little bit of target practice.
That's a very savvy move. And I think that where I've seen people make successful transitions into self-employment, consulting, startups, it very typically comes from that anchor client type of mentality where you build up that network doing something else. And then the opportunity comes along where you now have the credibility to do it under your own umbrella, which of course means that you need to fill out a bunch of vendor paperwork. Now you don't have the air cover of contract ops and all the stuff. So when you run all that yourself, what's your process for making proposals and doing billing and just all this stuff happens that is not your passion area? Like, how do you run your own company that way?
Yeah, I think for me, I'm a fairly organized person. And so I usually just try and stay on top of it, right? If something's coming in, like even if it's the initial conversation with a potential client, go ahead and make a folder in my OneDrive and put notes in there and put any slides or PDFs that they send me and that sort of thing. So I think the key is really staying organized with that first. And then, and like with the billing and stuff, yeah, that's been a learning experience too. You know, you could do things manually and write your own invoices and mail them out, or there are services that do invoicing for you in a little more of an automated way. And that's been really useful, especially like, for example, not to say some sort of sponsored thing here, but like Stripe, for example, is a tool that I use for all of my invoicing because it not only allows you to do like actual PDF invoices, which some organizations need, but it also allows you to make a payment page for some small biotech company that can just use a credit card. And that's really useful on the whole range of clients that I may have. And so finding something like that fits your kind of range of clients, it's really helpful with those services.
How do you balance your time across two different companies and academia? And, you know, I don't know that maybe you actually have a personal life too.
I think the biggest thing, and I've said this numerous times, because I've been asked that a lot, is calendar management. So oftentimes really making sure that your calendars are synced across the board. And the key, I think a lot of times, is to have standing meetings. So that, like today, it's a Tuesday. I know at 2 p.m. I have a call at Amisa with my team, right? That's happened for the last years. And so I know that if someone at Tuple is coming knocking on the door and saying, hey, can you chat at 2? No, I know I cannot chat at 2. I can talk to you at 3. And so I think the biggest thing with if you have multiple things going on is just making sure your calendar is very clean, very synced up and very up to date. And like I said, standing meetings really help to be able to make a quick decision in your head of can I meet at that time? Because you know what times you'd normally meet with whatever client or whatever, if your employees or whatever.
Do you ever find the overwhelm of many things? Like, how do you shut off? You know, like the challenge with remote work and independent work is you could sit in front of the computer all the time and, you know, to just not take care of yourself. How do you deal with that as an independent?
This happened yesterday. It was MLK Day. And so there's supposed to be off. A lot of companies and stuff were closed, but it was a good day to catch up. But it was one of those moments where it's 4 p.m. and I've sat here all day on a day that should have been a day off. Like, I haven't even folded my laundry yet. So, you know, it's this pile of laundry from my last trip. And so it's, I haven't really answered your question because I haven't really figured out an answer. The biggest thing with that is making sure that you do put breaks in your day. That is one thing that I like to do. I'm very remote in terms of how I work, but I oftentimes come to my office on campus to, because right after this call, I know I'm going to walk across the road and go get some Chipotle for lunch, and it helps break up otherwise monotonous day of working. And I would recommend that for anyone that does work remotely, get out of the house, go sit somewhere else, whether it's a coffee shop or a park or at your company or whatever. Because it will help to like just change things up in the monotony of a remote life.
And I find that it changing perspectives helps me sometimes solve a problem too. And that's where I'll let myself just not do it and then finally go out and go for a run or something. And stuff starts clicking and I'm like, oh, idiot. Like, you did it again. Like, you've been sitting in the same chair since Monday and you haven't changed your problem solving perspectives at all. And I think that, why is it so easy to forget the good things that you learned and not make a habit out of them? And I don't know, we're not going to solve that problem today.
Very true. I mean, I think sometimes a change of scenery really helps change your perspective and solve problems, or just also sometimes just the break of getting up in the morning, getting in the shower, driving to my office is a break enough to, like, I can't work on something while I'm driving. So I can at least just think about it rather than actually having to work on it, or I can listen to a podcast.
Right. Absolutely. No doubt it was this one. I guess I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about AI, right? Everybody wants to know about AI now. And I think what's interesting, I don't know anything about your disciplines, but I know they are the types of future solutions, right? That, of course, I care about pharmaceutical development and, you know, new crops and whatever things are going on there. How are you wrapping your head around the massive change and opportunity to solve just problems that were impossible to solve before were it not for this technological curve that is just so steep now?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's hard, and this is just academic research in general, and this is very cliche to say, but like the drinking from a fire hose sort of thing, where so many papers come out, so many announcements come out, so many tech companies are spun up and are doing different things. It's very difficult to know what is fluff and what's going to matter next week versus what are actual things that you could use to solve your own problems. And so I think right now, one of the biggest things in the AI space, despite AI being quite buzz-termy, is the use of AI in drug design. So that's kind of an side venture I've been working on recently, is understanding how at scale we can look at AI as the generator of drug candidates. And then also, how do we test those at scale as well? Because right now, drug development is very much like throwing spaghetti against a wall and seeing what sticks in a lab. And whatever sticks, then you continue to promote it through the process into trials and whatever. But really, that initial spaghetti throwing is quite inefficient and quite expensive. And so if you could translate that into, from a lab-based process, an in vitro process, into an in silico process, something that can run at scale on a cloud environment, for example, we could not only just reduce the amount of time and wasted on the spaghetti throwing, to belabor that point, but also to really start to scale up and really target the development of drugs that may increase the ability to cure a disease eventually.
And I read some story, you know, Pop Science, I think, not up to rigor of academia, but that in fact there are places where now, you know, I don't know, just the protein folding and the different sort of stuff that drugs or ideas for drugs or like that are actually being identified by models in novel ways that just humans never even thought about. Are there some cool stories there?
Yeah, currently, one of the current limitations of some of these models. So there are models that produce, like these large language models, LLMs that write sentences for you, or these tools like Midjourney or DALL-E that generate pictures. There are models now that generate amino acid sequences, which are the building blocks for proteins, right? So these amino acid sequences then fold into some sort of three-dimensional structure that we could get the protein that we could potentially use as a drug or for some other use case. One of the limitations, and that we've done well, we've done that for a couple of years, but one of the advancements that happened in like September, October last year is the ability to guide that generation. So we're not just making something that folds into some cool looking structure, but guide it in a way that actually meets and matches with a target or folds into something that looks like an antibody, for example, as opposed to just some blob. And that's where some of the stuff that you've probably seen are these novel protein structures, but we don't even know if those would even work in terms of a drug. And we don't even know, would they cause someone's immune system to go crazy, for example. But what I've been working on recently is building antibody-like structures that are fully synthetic that attack a specific cancer target. And so I'll have a preprint coming out of this in the next, hopefully, 2 weeks or so. But really, the thing right now is guiding the AI to do something that really looks a lot like the normal drug development process. It makes things that look like what we would see in a lab first, and then being able to test those and screen those at scale.
So we know there's a particular cell that we have as a receptor of some kind, and we want to plug that receptor with something that fits. So we need to make a molecule that, or protein that comes that way, and then put that puzzle together. So it's not just this random sort of, oh, look, you can do cool stuff. It's, I can actually solve the Rubik's Cube using tools that we can't work at that level. Because you're talking about like millions and millions of potential combinations that you couldn't try in real life.
But yeah, there's no way, right? So one project that I did with MIT a few months ago, we have a preprint out, but it's being peer reviewed right at the moment, is really trying to scale up that process, right? So when AlphaFold came out, you can run AlphaFold on a GPU on your laptop, but you're putting one sequence in, getting one structure out like pretty slowly. But how do you do that if you wanted to make 1,000 sequences? If you have 1,000 sequences and you want to fold all 1,000? And so we've successfully, Tuple and a group at MIT, we've been able to really scale that process up in high-performance computing, both cloud and on-premise as well. And so we're hoping that eventually it becomes this very easily deployable solution where if you want to make 1,000 drug candidates and test them in an in silico environment, you can do that in a matter of hours.
And is a silicon environment able to replicate the complexity of actual human cells?
Yeah, it does really well from a biochemical perspective, like understanding how two proteins might interact, for example, or two molecules. And what it doesn't replicate are the other bodily processes. For example, if you put a protein in the body, sometimes that might go through some sort of metabolism process and get broken down. And we don't really have the best way of modeling that at this point, not only just from a computation perspective, but just it just hasn't been done. And some of it in biology is just not well known enough to even model it. So there are other bodily processes in the environment of the body that we don't necessarily have the ability to model yet. If we constrain all of those things, then we can model interactions very accurately.
So like it's if you could get the drug where you wanted it to be, it would work, but getting it there would have it be broken down because of process X in your stomach or something like that. And we can't model that. That one feels like it would be cool.
We can model it a little bit. There are physics-based systems that can model those kind of complex things like that, but they are very computationally intense to run. And they're very, I would say, research academic at this point. So this is where I talk about kind of scaling things beyond from academia to enterprise. That has not been done for some of these physics-based systems. Now, there are neural network or deep learning-based systems that are doing some protein interaction work. I still think that's a little bit of early days, but we'll get there. It's coming.
What's the next couple of years going to look like? You must have to spend time with your futurist hat on when you do this type of work.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing will be, at least in the life sciences, will be some of this drug design or molecule design. I've even seen it being done for like material science and building new things there. I think that will be one of the biggest things. And then also, like I mentioned earlier, this onslaught of data that we're about to receive in the genomics world, because sequencing is getting cheaper and additional sequencing technologies are coming out. I think that's the next frontier, is how do we process that at scale and in an automated way too, so that you're not having to pay a bioinformatics person to click the run button and babysit some sort of process. It should just run and run successfully.
Right. Do we face limitations of storage space as well? You can read in the tech news that there aren't enough GPUs to train models. Are we going to produce so much data that we can't even store it?
I don't foresee that at the moment. I mean, that's one of the things where if you go to any of the big clouds, Azure, Microsoft Azure, AWS, whatever, storage is not something that you ever see any sort of capacity limitation on. You do see plenty of capacity limitations on GPUs at this point. So I don't think storage is going to be the problem, but I do think some of these processes that use GPUs, we're going to have to ramp up on that. One of the limitations I think that people may not understand is why NVIDIA is worth so much money is that they've monopolized the market on the technology that allows you to run things on GPUs. So there are plenty of GPUs out there that are great for gaming, for example, but if they don't have that NVIDIA sticker on them, then the software that runs things like TensorFlow and PyTorch and these deep learning models, it doesn't run on it, or it doesn't run on it nearly as well or as efficiently. And so that's where it's not just that we don't have enough GPUs, it's that we don't have enough GPUs from a specific manufacturer that have a specific compatibility to software that we've kind of boxed ourselves into. It's like mopping yourself into a corner.
Is it a commercial limitation, like patents and such? Or is it based on that essentially everybody wrote software to the leading architecture and that you need more of it and nobody else is allowed to make?
It's kind of the latter. And then it's also just some of it is the best platform to do that on. So therefore, so many of these software solutions were written toward that. And so now we've got to kind of undo it a little bit. And in order to make GPU usage more broad for GPUs that aren't NVIDIA GPUs.
Is this analogous to like x86 versus ARM versus RISC kind of thing?
Yeah, it's kind of like that as well, where that situation is a whole different podcast, but that situation is even more difficult because you're talking about the operating system and things just don't, and other software just doesn't work on it in general too. There are efforts to bridge the gap between these systems, especially in the GPU world. There was a project that came out, I don't know, maybe 2 years ago called Triton, that's by the OpenAI group, that is really supposed to allow you to use kind of any GPU. It's one of those things where we're so far embedded into the NVIDIA world that it is going to be difficult to undo that for a while.
Is this a problem of abstraction, like virtualization, that has to take place for this type of world? Or where I remember when everything moved from physical server to VM and then container, and then I became a sales guy and I don't know what's going on at all.
Well, I'm a tech guy and I still don't know what the hell is going on with that. So no, it is something to that effect of being able to write software that works. And a lot of times when you are talking about hardware, we're talking about writing software that has a very low level control of that piece of equipment. And so it's not just, I wrote something that needs to just turn this light on. Like, we're talking thousands of cores on a tiny chip that needs to be operationalized very efficiently. And that's where sometimes that's not the point of a $200 GPU that's supposed to be used for gaming. And so they don't really have the programming interface in order to just do that, even though it could in theory work for it. The ability for a developer to develop against that. The software development kits and APIs for that are just not quite there yet.
What do you wish for to happen if you could wave your magic life sciences technology wand over the next 5 years? What do you want?
Yeah, you mentioned a second ago about this x86 versus ARM processor war that's starting to happen. One of the things that's, for your listeners that may not be familiar, one of the things that's happened is companies like AMD and Intel for the last however many decades have had a monopoly on the x86 architecture. Very powerful, also power hungry. And then there's a company called ARM that was able to create a different sort of processor architecture that is a lot more efficient in terms of power. And also, depending on how the software is run on it, it could be faster as well. So one of the problems I think that I see right now is a lot of companies, these big tech companies, are making their own ARM-like architecture or chips. So Microsoft has them for their, and AWS has announced them for the big data centers. If you have a brand new Mac, you have the M123 whatever Mac chip in your Mac, right? And that's not always compatible with things. And so previously we had two players, we had Intel and AMD, and they just worked. And then now we're getting to the point where now most of these companies are having ARM-based architectures are coming out with their own, but now we've got far more than two players in that space. And I don't necessarily have a magic wand or a crystal ball to know what that's going to entail, but it would be really interesting. What I hope for, to answer your question, is I hope that all of that starts working together really well. Because otherwise, as a developer, it makes your life really hard if you're on your MacBook and that what you're working on there and building does not translate to a cloud environment very easily. We're going to have a lot of problems with that.
Is this like the VHS Betamax?
Absolutely. You're showing your age a little there, but yeah.
I am. I know I probably half our listeners don't even know what that is, but
yeah, DVD versus Blu-ray maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Still, my kids don't know what a disc is.
It definitely is that, right? Compatibility is everything. And if you have to buy a new piece of equipment to develop on or to just run your whatever it is on, that's annoying. It's annoying and expensive and inefficient.
Do you work around efficiency relative to, there's a lot of chatter about it takes an incredible amount of water and energy, and it's just the footprint of these AI models now is chewing up all kinds of power that has to come from somewhere that probably isn't sustainable at the moment. Is that a concern?
Yes and no. I think one of the things that's been really interesting is that some of these platforms that host these AI models, like Hugging Face, for example, is one of them. They will actually tell you what the carbon footprint is for training that model. But they can also tell you, too, if you run this on a certain type of machine for this long, this is the equivalent of driving your car this many miles. Americans will use everything but the metric system. You get that sort of view. The other thing, too, that I think is we don't necessarily need to continue to remake GPT-4 every single time, right? Or DALL-E every single time. And so what we're seeing now are these open source models that are considerably smaller and can be run on less sophisticated equipment and therefore have a less power suck than these giant models that require a giant data center to run. So what I hope is that the innovation starts making it where these giant models become less necessary and we really have more portable and open source or easier to run versions of these models that don't have as much of a carbon footprint on them.
Yeah. Is it Mistral, I think is?
Yeah. Mistral is one. And then there are even versions where these researchers have made an even compressed version of these existing models that where you compress the model to something that can run on a laptop GPU, but with only a very minuscule amount of performance impact in terms of how good the LLM sample. That'll be really interesting to see that sort of take off. Like the cell phone thing, you know, all of a sudden cell phones got really tiny and then they got a little bigger. So is that going to happen to LLMs? Now we're on the bag phone version of GPT, right? And then are we going to get down to like Razor and then grow back up? What's going to happen with that?
I guess that's very similar to the first genome took, what, a decade or more? And, you know, it's just incredible resources. Now you're talking about $100, which the logarithmic, you know, increasing power and efficiency, I guess that's the singularity then. So we can get all kinds of philosophy around that one. So what's next as we wrap up? You've got your constellation of startups and service companies and academia. What does that look like going forward for you?
Yeah, this is where the crystal ball or magic wand that you talked about would be really used. The next kind of frontier is really, for me and for Tuple, is really starting to productize or package up a lot of the solutions so that instead of me having to do it 25 more times, now it's something that is deployable and more accessible. I do a lot of open source work. So a lot of the stuff that I develop, it's on my GitHub. You can go grab it. And so what you're really paying me for right now is the implementation thereof, if you need help in doing it and doing it your way. And so that's what I'm going to continue working on, is really packaging up some of the solutions that have been built and then really delivering that value in more of a platform service kind of way. And then also, like I mentioned, this kind of generative AI and drug development is something that I'm very interested and passionate in, and have already in 2023 made a lot of headway in scalability there. And like I said, in the next couple of weeks, we'll have a paper come out that's going to be more along the lines of showing an actual example for a drug target in cancer. And so outside of that, not really sure yet. I think I spend a lot of my time really chasing and following a lot of what's happening in the tech world. Like being a Microsoft partner is sometimes quite challenging because things change so quickly. I will spend and continue to spend a lot of my time making heads or tails of that and ensuring that my clients have the latest and greatest.
Final sort of question. How could you generalize, Wigan, the thinking about that interdisciplinary sort of problems that you're aware of and have seen being solved? Can you generalize that to, you know, sort of the other businesses and domains that are listening?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things that we're seeing is these giant tech companies, Microsoft, AWS, Google, whatever, are becoming a little less vendor locked in terms of their solutions. So one of the things that we're seeing 10 years ago, the thing was you've got to move everything to the cloud. and it has to be cloud or cloud only. And then the messaging softened a little bit and it was cloud first. Let's put most of your stuff in the cloud. And then it softened a little bit more where you have this hybrid cloud where you've got an on-premise environment, you've got a cloud environment. And so if you're a tech executive listening to this podcast, you're like, oh yeah, it's all this because it softened. And then now what's happened is hybrid cloud really means on-premise and then usually one or more of the big cloud vendors. So you might have a pocket of Azure and a pocket of AWS and some other things. And so what I'm seeing is that these vendors, these cloud vendors are really making it to where that's okay with the announcement of Microsoft Fabric and Microsoft or Azure OneLake last year. That was really a big thing. It doesn't matter if you have an AWS storage account, an S3 account over there, that's fine. We can help you pull from that and query it. Doesn't matter if you have some on-premise stuff, we can pull from that and put it on a Power BI dashboard. And we're seeing that kind of replicated across the different vendors as well. But they want you to do as much as you want on their environment, but they realize they're losing that battle. And so if you do have multiple environments, they want to make sure that you can connect to and use the data in those environments across the board.
That data accessibility and utility seems to be the driving force there.
And I think one of the things too is in compute capacity, right? That's really the most expensive thing to do in the cloud. Storage is very cheap. So if you have some stuff stored in all sorts of different pockets, it's a mess. But in terms of if it lives in different environments, the biggest thing is they would rather you process that data in their cloud because that's where they make the most money. And that's what charges you the most money to your subscriptions.
Yeah. And I think you could apply that then across business domains and in terms of, I seem to be seeing that most businesses looking for higher ROI in any of the areas, finance, marketing, sales, and anything, it's really about attribution and data and better visualization and all these things seem to be, everything else is becoming standard, but the parties that are providing the best understanding of the results seem to be the ones that are standing.
Yeah, if you have better visibility into your company by way of data, then you have the leg up. That is really how it works. That works. Doesn't matter if we're talking about pharma or retail or finance or whatever. And that's something that I spoke a lot of it about in a couple of conferences last year, was really organizing your data and being very mindful of where you put your data and how it's organized. Because if you get that, the rest of the stuff is quite simple. It's very easy to spin up a very large compute environment and query from the data as long as that data is organized. And that's something that I feel like I harp on a lot when I speak at conferences and stuff, but it truly is the most important thing, because having data that's accessible is data that's usable. And if it's usable, then you can slap together a really easy dashboard that can really deliver a considerable amount of insights that otherwise would be completely hidden from you.
And I would guess it has a lot to do, not just with storage and organization, but in the way you think about data as an accessible resource. So the organization of and tagging of, and it's not enough that it lives somewhere. It's that it lives somewhere in some kind of structure that doesn't require massive amounts of work and transformation every time you go and want it to talk to something else.
Yeah, there are two aspects of that. One is this concept of data governance. So having the ability to view your whole data estate, and that cringe every time I say that term, but the whole data estate with all these different kind of data repositories all over the place. And the governance of that is really interesting, especially if you work in a very regulated environment like finance or healthcare, where you need to know who has access to what. And not only that, you use the word tagging. What is in that storage account that you have? Is it personally identifiable information? Is it proprietary? If it got all serious, is it, right? And having that purview into that is interesting and is really valuable for a company. And the other two, you know, with all these things happening with generative AI and lawsuits coming from the New York Times or whatever about the use of open data in these proprietary models, really is a valuable asset, right? And so not only is it useful if you have it organized, but also just keeping it safe and keeping it to you, to internal to your company so that you can actually do something with it is really deliver all that ROI.
Colby, thank you for the insights. Really interesting conversation. Anybody that's resonating, you got all kinds of things going on, but how would they best reach out to you?
Pretty big on LinkedIn. I post a lot, so you can search me there, Colby Ford. And then if you're interested in Tuple, it's tuple.xyz, and you can reach out to me there.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for coming out and sharing your insights. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed this episode of the Leaders of B2B podcast. And as always, you can see more information about this episode and all the resources mentioned at leadersofb2b.com. If you enjoyed the show, please give us a 5-star rating. This episode is brought to you by Content Allies. We help B2B companies launch revenue-generating podcasts. We schedule interviews between you and your ideal prospects and strategic partners. You show up for engaging conversations, we handle everything else. Ready to build a podcast that grows your business in just 1 hour per week? Reach out to us at contentallies.com.